typically realize that, and that in fact is the issue, and that is, or a major part of the issue, in the distinction between the use of polygraph testing as applied to suspicious criminal situations or general screening situations, such as a crime.
Okay. Well, say hello to everyone, and also apologize for my repeating text here. I picked up that precinct for putting up the text. The progress taken is better in the United States, so I'll try to keep my comments brief. In light of what Patty said, you can think about the following comments and addressing this question: what are the features of mass extinction be used to reduce that region of indeterminate, you know, that overlap sub-region to the region where there's greater certainty? And in particular, I'd like to address whether the state of the field allows substitution of the measure
John, you're cranking up a little bit. I think the best thing is trying to talk right into the mouth. Okay, is that better? Yeah, that's a little bit better. It fades in and out a little. And we had the problem yesterday, though, as well. I think the instrument here. Okay, I'll just tell me a bit of the crack stuff, all right? Okay. I'm going to cover a brief bit of historical basis, line section. Tied
a little bit to work earlier in this century. I'll keep those comments brief because I assume some of that was covered yesterday. Talk just a moment about speech collection. And I think Kathy and Peter noted a feature I want to point out, and that is highly theoretical and important to some more theoretical approaches that might be derived from the field. We can measure the top of multiple determinants of the measures that are there. One of the things that we did in this article that's in the notebook is bring a bit of a Bayesian analysis to the field. In particular, this term I'm going to point at, try to talk about how we might think about life text in terms of a subset of literature. I'll just comment on Gatt's work articles, because he too took a very similar approach than my paper I have seen before. Then I want to return to measurement selection and cover the topic of individual vision. Did mention that. I think it wants being brought back in this context. And I'm going to split that to the biometric and psychometric relevance of individual differences, context specificity, and the issue of cross validation, all of the problems, which is a significant problem in the field. And then end with just countermeasures, the different application of countermeasures by building it as an individual communication for how you might determine that subset of metrics. Okay? Let's start with historical basis. If you look back several thousand years, landowners and rulers have often wanted to know who was telling the truth, who was lying. And the original procedures were simply putting individuals in a dark room with a donkey. They were told to kick them if they lied, and the donkey, they had to hold the donkey's tail when they were asked questions. And they had greased the donkey's tail, and when the individual came out, they looked to see whether their hand was greasy. Basically, very much like the Bovis pipeline procedure that Jim talked about, and really got at the pressure to tell the truth under the conditions of life extension. That's a valuable use of it today. The second part was this physiological differentiation. The earliest physiological differentiation of lying involved putting right in people's mouth. And then asking questions. If they were anxious or hungry, they were lying. They would salivate less, and therefore it would be much more difficult to articulate answers. And that was the problem with those procedures. The latter, the same problems we see today, and that's a very high false thing. Earlier part of this century, autonomic measurements became possible in electrodermal blood pressure and respiratory changes are the typical set of measures that are used in classic polygraphy. And as Vicky and Jim pointed out, there are significant problems with each of them. Electrodermal activity, going back to 1930, Landis in a review article called The Psychological Significance of the Psychogalvanic Greenlight talked about the many different causes of an electrodermal response, ranging from motor to cosmic to emotional. This is the problem both in terms of trying to making sense of that electrodermal response when they're lying because of mental effort, because of anxiety. There's also significant individual evidence is that, or even just the need for the person to come up, the political to come up with the hip response.
John?
Yeah.
You're breaking up. Hold on.
Yeah. May we actually call you right back?
Sure.
Okay. Give us about 10 minutes. We'll call you right back.
Okay.
Thanks.
You've given a wonderful discussion. Great. And not my apologies, at least if we can have mission strategy.
Of lying. And so you can kind of break that down And there's a term in the denominator that's helpful to keep in mind, and that's the probability of the physiological pattern or feature that you're looking at. Let's just use electrodermal response as a simple surrogate. What's the likelihood of statement of electrodermal response, not only when they're lying, but when they're not lying? Just what's the base rate? And not even the base rate, but just that particular component of the base rate, the presence of that physiological response, electrodermal response, when they're not lying. Just because they're anxious, just because they're conscientious, just because they're vigilant and happen to be a lay-low person. And that's the false alarm problem. And one way to, and I'd like to ask you, if you look at the Gasworth article, one of the reasons for this increased false alarm rate or decreased utility of these tests as the prevalence goes down is because the particular term I just mentioned is larger. Okay, the prevalence is high, then that term's meant to decrease. So one of the ways of doing this is if you want to do research where you can look at a physiological response and make some inference about lying or some other psychological interpretation, you want to make sure that particular term is as small as possible. One way to try to do that, one thing that in medical tests they do is they pay a lot of attention to the assessment context. And that's an important feature I want to come to in just a moment. A second process that's done is a lot of attention to the spatial and temporal patterning or the classification of multiple variables in the set. And I think that the three people, Kathy and Peter and John, spoke to statistical issues in trying to identify that set. As I mentioned, and as Richie alluded to, we have better understandings of the underlying neuroanatomy to help us define better sets than you see used in most polygraphy tests. But I think most of us would contend that knowledge, if anything, would raise caveats. We could do better, but I'm not convinced we can do a satisfactory job and eliminate that false alarm problem. Okay, let's go to this context specificity. The idea here is to know what all the determinants of the physiological response are so that you're better able to protect against those determinants. It's only in that means, only by that way, can you reduce this region of overlap. Because the region of overlap is there specifically because there are other factors producing that physiological response besides the variable that you're trying to discriminate along. In the area of psychophysiology, we know that the context is going to be dramatically affected by individuals. Particularly problematic for lie detection, I believe, is the issue of individual differences. Richie alluded to this, but I want to just review very, very briefly something about the history of what we know and then get to the components of variance in this individual difference parameter. Mammal NGS, 1949, noticed that for any given set of measurements and stressors, some individuals tend to respond with maximal activation in specific systems. They further noticed that people who had psychosomatic complaints, let's say of headaches or cardiovascular complaints, tended to show maximal response in those specific systems. And they demonstrated, for instance, in their psychiatric population, people complaining of headaches showed greater muscular tension in the frontalis region, the forehead region. People who complained of heart palpitations showed greater heart rate variability. Out of that work came contributions by John Lacey and colleagues. And a term called individual response stereotypy emerged. That's just a generic concept referring to the fact that physiological responses can be viewed as a function of individuals, rather as a general and diffuse arousal response. If you parse that variance, if you look at the components of that, there's a couple of interesting components that might be worth trying to model. One is relative response specificity, which means for a given set of measurements, individuals tend to respond with maximal activation and the same physiological response across a variety of structures. There's response hierarchy, and this means for a given set of measurements, individuals tend to exhibit a reliable or stereotypic ordering of physiological responses to a set of stimuli. There are differences in how rigid that response hierarchy is across individuals. There's individual uniqueness, which means a group of individuals can be characterized or are unique in their physiological responses or response patterns to a stimulus. And then there is this, some of these parameters, like individual response stability or instability, varies across age. As you get older, your response profiles tend to become more rigid. And those tend to be the major components that we know about in terms of the individual differences. If we take that and we look, try to take specific context, as you to define all these situational factors that can lead to a profile of responses, and then you consider these individual differences. Let's say that we use an unsupervised learning model like Kathy and Peter have mentioned. The issue of overfitting is one that you see in the literature currently. For instance, Barbo and Dunshin, about 6 years ago now, published an article on ERP detection of lines. And they used the bootstrapping method and did very, very well in their classification. What they did do, however, was to do a cross-validation. J.P. Rosenfeld at Northwestern has been doing some ERP work looking at a particular ERP waveform that's associated with an attention to disease. There, too, he's done a better job of trying to cross-validate, and he finds a significant degradation. Even in those studies, however, there isn't much variation in context, and that's, I think, an error. I think if we come up with an algorithm, even at the best, these are not doing well, but to know really in the kind of situation that you want to generalize to know how well that's going to perform, you don't want to have a training set, put it in half, derive the features in one and cross-validate on the other, because you still have a fairly homogeneous set. And in fact, what we have are very, very different assessment contexts as you go across different examiners, as you go across different types of crime. And the issue of countermeasures can come in here because that itself is a very different kind of context. And so you want to have, I think, Kathy, you alluded to this, you need a number of covariates. If you're going to really do this, you need to include in that design covariates that consider the severity of the crime, the use of countermeasures, the type of countermeasures, the gender, and a number of features about the examiner as well as the examining. So that's a very quick summary of what we said in that article that has applied to lie detection.
Wow.
Thank you.
Comments, amplifications from anyone? I'm keeping an eye on the clock and mindful we're also going to lose John at some point before too long, and thought that we should try to fit in our last couple of topics. The last two really relate to two disparate directions of activities and content for our deliberations and ultimately possibly for recording in a report. One relates to other ways to think about deception and its measurement or indicators for it. And I think it's sort of natural to think about that now. And then we'll come back to David and a reminder about policy and legal issues. I assume we'll get that reminder every meeting. So if we cut you short, it won't be permanently, it will be locally.
Outline as well.
I was going to point out, he's already sort of extracted some legal things for us, which I found edifying as I looked at this. So, Mark, maybe you want to...
Well, I hadn't prepared any formal...
Well, that's even better.
Formal remarks about this, and it will probably help your scheduling, but I think in just listening to things that Richie said and the comments that I made along the way, as we consider these measures, these peripheral measures, I keep harking back to the notion that it's the brain that's causing all this, and that there is an emerging field of work that looks at what the brain is actually doing under these circumstances. And I think as we look forward in terms of what may happen over the next decade in really addressing this kind of a problem, that we should at least be cognizant of what's going on there. And it might be of some use to this panel at some point to be a little more explicit about what we're talking about here and give some examples, and I didn't bring them with me or
Well, okay, so the two technologies that are mentioned regularly in the stuff that we've been given are quite different. So P300 is a technology which is not future, but is more, is very different than fMRI.
P300 is, I'm not the man to talk about P300, but there may be somebody around the table who can speak more.
So you're really talking about
I'm talking about looking at what's going on in the brain in the spatial sense. What pieces of the brain are doing what on what occasion, and how that relates to, say, an interaction between a cognitive act and some emotional ongoing processing. And people that are working in this field, I think, are becoming ever more acutely aware of the fact that you can observe this kind of interaction in these kinds of data sets. And it's certainly more obvious as these techniques become more sophisticated, but our level of understanding of how all this is operating, and particularly what roles areas of the brain are playing, I think is a long way from fully developed. Well, we can say we know a tremendous amount about the amygdala, and in all likelihood, the amygdala in humans is arguably operating not too differently than amygdala in some of our nearer relatives and maybe even some of our more distant relatives. But that's hardly the full extent of the areas concerned with emotional processing in the brain. And I liken the view of the amygdala in the imaging world to the view with regard to emotion as hippocampus was to memory. And both of them, I would say, emotion has been amygdalocentric, and memory was, until imaging got into the game, hippocampocentric. And I think if the world has told us, this kind of world has told us anything, it is that there's a whole lot of other things going on, which we could have guessed from a lot of the anatomical work and the connectivity having to do with limbic processing areas in cortex and the like. And we're beginning to understand what role they're playing. They're clearly there. They're clearly announcing their presence in very interesting ways. And as I kind of sit as a party to this discussion, I can't help but believe that knowledge of that kind of information would eventually be very valuable if these are important in making a distinction between when somebody's telling the truth and when they're not. But are we ready to do this now? I don't think so. But I think we should keep this sort of thing in mind, and maybe my views will evolve as I begin to understand a little bit better how good the current techniques are relative to what we know about the potential for these newer ways of approaching. As I've indicated, at least with regard to imaging, moving from estimates of what's going on across a group of people to accurately depicting what's going on in a single individual is the direction in which we're moving. I think I would be very uncomfortable with the notion that we had a technique that could look at an individual with any precision present time and discern the level of emotional processing that was occurring juxtaposed to some particular cognitive activity. I mean, we might suspect that it was occurring. There's clearly a lot of individual variability in this data, some of it probably has to do with the pure statistical properties of imaging data in general. But I think over and above that, anybody who looks at this stuff thoughtfully, we can do this much more readily. readily now with functional imaging has to be impressed with the fact that there is significant individual variability that transcends the statistical properties of the imaging data. So I think as the deliberations proceed here, the role of this or electrical techniques, the P300, are we doing, for example, the best job with, could we do a better job with MEG versus dense electrode EEG? If you get into that sort of thing, how far could we push it and how should that relate to imaging? These are active topics in the world in which I operate. And we could certainly put them on the table as issues to be considered for the future and areas where efforts ought to be directed, because I guess my reaction to it is that the kind of measures we're using to infer what the brain is doing are kind of frozen in a time that's very distant from the present as far as brain and neuroscience is concerned. And to bring these two together makes eminently good sense in the future. If I were to be judged in the context of whether I'm lying or not, I'd like the very best technique applied to this so that people come out of it with as little doubt as possible as to what my brain is really doing. And I worry a little that we're a bit frozen in time here, and we need to think in more modern terms about how to do this, even in the context, for example, of the very measures that are currently being used, whether it be respiration or cardiac function. Again, I suspect, as somewhat of an outsider in listening to this, that based on what Jim was saying this morning and what we've heard over meals and elsewhere, that our level of sophistication is far in excess of what's actually being applied as a routine measure. So I think the panel has got to look at where neuroscience is, where human neuroscience is. That's what's key. It doesn't matter what we can do with electrode recording in a rat, which we can do an awful lot of, or even in a monkey. It matters what we can do in humans, and that's moving so fast now that I think it's got to be part of this discussion.
More than that, has anybody suggested a commission paper on this area? I would like to see such a thing for myself and the rest of the panel, but I think it would be a neat thing to have attached a separate volume, perhaps a commission paper, but a nice thing to go along with our plan for the quarter. I've been intrigued by what you've been saying, but I would really like to see it laid out by,
I think it could be done. I think the other thing, of course, I've been fascinated, some of these things I know and some I'm being rich in listening, but the whole statistical approach to the kind of data that I work with is an immensely interesting and challenging and hardly developed area. I mean, we're dealing with a huge amounts of data. I listen with great fascination to the kind of things you're talking about here, because we're grappling with complex data sets. Sometimes we have good ideas about what's in there, and other times these are basically hypothesis generating, because we're trying to figure out how the human brain works, and the first thing we have to almost admit is we don't really know how it works. So hypotheses that go in and divide the brain up like a piece of pie are fraught with difficulty. This is kind of the old way of doing it, and we've had to say it ain't going to work. So then the question is, how do we deal with this? And I gather astronomers deal with this. All kinds of people deal with these very complex and variable data sets that have all of this stuff in it. And you look at it, and its richness is astounding, and it's reproducible. Now the question is, how do we understand it?
Well, and the new statistical tools for analyzing imaging take advantage of a whole set of other aspects, spatial temporal structures, and registration. It's all the sets of issues that you know well from your own work, I assume, that go off in another direction. I'm struck, and this may be a useful segue from your observations to David is that if we were to go back 20 years and look at the forensic literature and ask what people did in the area of genetics, there were uses of blood for a variety of forensic purposes. It tended to be very simple blood systems and simple laboratory measurements. And that work went back for about 70 years to the development of basic genetic systems by Fisher and some of his colleagues. It was right at the verge of people using molecular techniques to look at DNA data of various sorts, and people kept on saying, oh, we'll be able to measure it accurately. I think if we had commissioned 6 papers then, now, they all would have said that in different ways. There would have been some skeptics, perhaps, and none of them would have predicted the system that would have evolved, nor would they have uniformly guessed how rapid that evolution would have occurred. I want to emphasize the latter. So, and when it began to be introduced, it was a subject of great controversy in the legal setting, also in the scientific setting at some level. But now the arguments are over orders of magnitude, and they're way out in the tail of the distribution, and so it's a very different debate. And that's all happened in a decade or so, a total turnaround. And maybe there's a lesson in that as well. It's not that this is DNA fingerprinting, or that they're just the two of them have, but you. We're just at a totally different place thinking about the kind of evidence that's available.
Well, I think, in regard to the legal issues, occasionally I find it interesting to reflect on how the legal system addresses issues of responsibility and so forth. And again, you know, you have to think, you know, these are questions that I would call cognitive neuroscience. Is if they haven't thought about it yet, they're going
to be thinking about it. Where's the non-material at?
Yeah. We will be thinking about this.
It's going to be hard.
So, David, do you want to take over?
Oh, I'm sorry. I just want one point on the alternative indicators. And that is that there are some alternative indicators which are not central, which are not brain. And it's really not my area of expertise, but I'm wondering if you want to explore them or not. And specifically, we have the facial electromyography things that have been mentioned. And then there is this article, which I certainly didn't thoroughly on the pupillary response. So there are,
I wasn't able to attend, but there was a presentation a week or two ago at George Mason on reaction times. So how fast you could answer questions on memorized items. Was this an item you had memorized or not? And they threw in a few guilty knowledge items? And your reaction time was slower on the guilty knowledge items on whether it was in the list you'd memorized or not?
Well, Dick Schiffman certainly can comment on
that. Yeah, and then we'll have Paul to comment on faces. So clearly there's an array of things there spanning the brain-related measurement technology and cognitive perspective through this whole range of alternatives. And not only do we have to catalog them, but we have to get somebody to say something about their relevance or potential relevance. and just how much I think is going to be one of the issues that we'll grapple with.
I would think that'll become clearer as the process evolves.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay, I'll try to make this really quick. There's an outline coming around to you, and basically what I would like to do is give you some sense of, from my perspective, how our report is going to be used and consumed by the legal audience, the policy-making audience. And I think it might surprise you, they're not scientists, they don't understand, they haven't had a math course probably since 9th or 10th grade. They cannot distinguish a mean from a median from a mode, so there's going to be some difficulty in their consuming this information. I just want to give you kind of the lay of the land. First of all, on the employment screening, and some of the material later on is relevant to the employment screening, what I would say is on the back end. That is, if the Defense Department gets sued, as they are now being sued, or the FBI is being sued, for either firing people or not hiring people, some of these tests will be used to evaluate constitutional violations. So there's a front-end use, which is on the screening, but even in screening, when people don't get what they want, they very often litigate, and so therefore they end up asserting either statutory or constitutional violations. So a lot of the later stuff is relevant to screening, too. What I did was I just went through the Polygraph Protection Act. It's really not that relevant to what we're doing. It applies to general governmental employers. It prohibits the lie detector use for any employee or prospective employee subject to exemptions. Since we're in the business of the exemptions, in fact, in the face of some of the congressional action, to the contrary of EPPA, again, this is less relevant, but just to lay out. In a sense, the federal government is telling us that they don't really believe in the widespread use of polygraphs. However, there are contexts that where false negatives
What's the year of that?
Excuse me? What?
1980.
Yes.
88.
88 is the word. Okay. So government employers, national defense, FBI, and so forth. And then there are uses that are allowed in the private employer context. However, they are pursuant to specific investigations and so it's more of a specific issue or specific use of the polygraph. Rules of admissibility, just to note, first of all, rules of admissibility are used both directly and by analogy. So when the court, for example, will evaluate the constitutionality of a firing or a not hiring, very often they will use these rules of admissibility to evaluate a scientific technique or assess some scientific evidence. There's basically two tests that exist today. The first test is from 1923, actually was developed with the use of the polygraph of the time, the lie detector test in 1923. The D.C. Circuit held that the technology was not good enough to allow in. The reason why was the court said, well, we have to evaluate, first of all, qualifications, but second of all, and most importantly, the general acceptance of the technique in the particular field. And when the court looked at the field of polygraphy at the time, it did not find general acceptance. Now, and that's the test, general acceptance in the particular field. There are a number of things that are extremely important to note about Frye. First of all, Frye is applied by a minority of states, not applied in the federal courts. However, it's applied in the big states. It's applied in New York, it's applied in Florida, it's applied in California, it's applied in Arizona, and a number of others. In terms of number of cases, arguably Frye is applied in more cases than is the alternative, which is the Daubert test. One of the realities of Frye is that Frye is extremely deferential to the identified field, whatever that identified field might be. The problem has been, this is identifying the pertinent field. And just like if you ask calligraphers, of course, it's generally accepted. If you ask tea leaf readers whether tea leaf reading is generally accepted, the answer is yes. And the courts are sensitive to some extent to that problem, but because they're not scientifically sophisticated, they don't always know what field to sample, what noses to count to determine whether something is generally accepted. However, Fry does, other than picking a particular field, require relatively little scientific sophistication among the judges. For judges, that is a great benefit of the test, the virtue. For us, depending on your inclination, Marcia Angel, for example, the former editor of New England Journal, wrote specifically saying she doesn't want judges to be scientifically sophisticated because she doesn't think they could ever be scientifically sophisticated, so they ought to rely on scientists for those judgments. I personally have a different view of the matter, but there are a number of scientists who take that view, and an awful lot of judges, an awful lot of lawyers take that view that judges should simply rely on the scientific community. In regard to how this committee's work is likely to be perceived by Fry jurisdiction, it is, first of all, going to be used. There's actually no question about it. The National Academy of Sciences, if there's any group that's going to give you a sense of so-called general acceptance, it's going to be this sort of group. Also, I think that the composition of the committee is going to deeply affect courts. Courts have tended so far to only look at psychophysiologists. They haven't looked at biostatisticians or social psychologists or others or statisticians. And so the fact that this committee is so broadly represented or representative of the scientific community, I think is actually going to affect the courts and how they evaluate scientific evidence through polygraphs. The alternative test is a test that was articulated in Daubert versus Novak Pharmaceuticals. It's an opinion written by Justice Blackmun, who is generally perceived as one of the more scientifically sophisticated justices on the court over time. I think Justice Breyer probably now qualifies for that mantle. Again, you have to have qualifications of the expert. Qualifications have to be fitted to whatever the expertise is. You also have to have relevance or fit, what we would call generalizability. Do the data, does the research fit the legal question that's presented in this particular case? Again, it's just a legal inquiry that the court will make. The third factor is evidentiary reliability or scientific validity. The court's for a long time talked. They use reliability and validity interchangeably. They are starting to understand that scientists understand reliability and validity differently, but it is evidentiary reliability deemed scientific validity. Justice Blackmun applying Karl Popper's notions of falsification or falsifiability adopted a